Well, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for the invitation to speak. Let me begin by acknowledging my colleagues. Much of the substance of what I'm going to present today is part of a DOE project looking at integrated assessment of climate change. And we've discussed some of the ideas, some of the more speculative ideas, but those parts that you like, credit them. Those parts that you don't like, those are on me. And I feel like you have me at a bit of a disadvantage here in that I'm not a horticultural scientist. You folks know much more about the biology of horticultural plants than I do, as the introduction said. I'm an ecosystem science looking at how climate change might affect ecosystems. So hopefully what I'll give you are some ideas, some things to think about, rather than specific little factoids for you to carry away. Now there will also be some repetition of some points and themes that Bob presented, but there was no collusion. There's no climate conspiracy here. These are just some independent ideas. It's interesting to see we're coming to some of the same conclusions. I want to talk a little bit about the near-term climate predictions and the issues of scale associated with that, and then modeling crop physiology, and then end with a proposal of sorts for impact assessment. Now, most of you have seen graphs like this. They're basically showing the change in global average annual temperatures out through to 2100, for different emission scenarios that Bob was talking about. These are from the fourth assessment, but it's the same idea. High emissions result in higher temperatures. Now, you might see some of these sort of things in USA Today, but maybe not USA Today, maybe New York Times, something like that. But what you won't see there, but most of you are probably familiar with, those global averages are the results of geographically resolved models. And they do things, many things beyond just temperature. They do precipitation, of course, and lots of other things. But that geographical resolution is pretty coarse, anywhere from 100 kilometers to 200 kilometers in resolution. So from the impact assessment point of view, it's usually thought that that's too coarse to be very useful. So there'll be many discussions of how you downscale from those global model results through the region down to local. And even the local is sort of in the eyes of the beholder, because for the most part, those local fine-scale, downscale results are somewhere on the order of 50 kilometers resolution, still pretty coarse. Now, you can get down using different techniques to 12 kilometers. A group there at Oak Ridge has done one down to 4 kilometers for the U.S., and you can, in localized areas, get down to even 1 kilometer. But for most of the time, like in the National Climate Assessment, they're using 50-kilometer downscaled results. This is just an example of those downscaled results. Change in the number of nights below 32 degrees in my naivete about horticulture, I thought that might be an interesting temperature metric. Showing what you would sort of expect, that there's fewer cold, freezing nights in the warming, not so much in Florida, but in the Tennessee-Kentucky area. But that's not the scale that I actually want to talk about. I want to talk about the other scale, the temporal scale. And Bob was talking about some of these things as well. This is another plot of temperature change by emission scenarios, in this case using the RCP scenarios that Bob talked about. And what I want you to look at, as also Bob mentioned, is that for at least two of those, and the 2.6 is not even on here because most people don't think we can get there. That was pretty much given up on that one. That the 6.0 and the 4.5 really don't distinguish themselves from each other until out mid-century. And even if you look at the uncertainty around those scenarios, they hardly ever resolve themselves. Now, the 8.5 one does resolve in the mean, but even there, if you look at the variability and the uncertainty around there, you're looking out at close to 2040 or so before they start to distinguish each other. So one of the main things that the climate models are used for is to project climate change given the uncertainties of we don't know what our emissions trajectories are going to be. So you do different scenarios, but in the next decade to 20 years, those scenarios don't make any difference, right? And zoom in on the next 20 years, and if you can't distinguish amongst all that colored spaghetti, the different AR5, the different scenarios, that's sort of the point. That out the next 20 years, they don't distinguish themselves from each other. And you can even argue that the most likely range is closer to what an extrapolation of the historical trends have been, which is the green lines, a couple of different green and blue, a couple of different reconstructions. So I would argue, following some of the sort of things that Bob was talking about, that for the next 10 to 20 years, and not beyond that, I'm only talking about the next decade or two, that the most appropriate near-term projections may in fact be those empirical trends, and that we won't be far off by using the empirical trends as an alternative to using the climate change models. Now, a point that I'm not going to develop that's sort of related to that is that as you look at more and more extreme events, things like hailstorms or individual floods, the uncertainty from the models goes up with that. So that, to me, that's another argument for using historical trends in things like that to the extent you can to do the projections for the next decade or so. Now, making that argument for using them doesn't make the problem easier. It just makes it different. This is, even in the Southeast, the daily minimum temperature, the nighttime temperature, has been increasing over the past 100 years. But it may not be that you want to project that long-term trend as a simple linear trend line, because you have all that variability around it, right? And it's obviously going to make a difference if you start your trend in 1970 as opposed to starting your trend in 1895. So the problem isn't easier, it's just different. And there are more sophisticated ways of doing the trend analysis and doing projections of those trends, doing time series analysis and such, than just using a simple linear trend like that. But I would still argue that for 10 to 20 years out, you're probably better off, particularly in trying to do assessments locally. Because, again, the uncertainty goes up with the models as you get to those finer and finer scales, where you might have very good trend data for a particular location. Again, I would argue that for the near term, using those historical trends is probably... it is certainly useful and may be the most appropriate. Now I'm going to switch gears here a little bit and finally start talking about plants a little bit more. And mostly from, again, the perspective of a modeler. I'm an ecosystem modeler. I'm not even a plant physiologist, although I hang out with plant physiologists all the time and work with them very closely. But what I've learned from them. And one of the main points is that most all of the models that I know about look at productivity and growth. They simulate productivity and growth to get at yield, basically. We're talking about agricultural models here. The DSAT, very common agricultural model, that's mostly what it simulates, EPIC, others as well. They also do, and this is important, of course, for temperate plants, they do phenology, but the phenology that they're talking about there is mostly the onset of leaves and the loss of leaves or the death of the plant for an annual crop. What they don't do from the perspective of agricultural crops and horticultural crops is they do not, the kinds of generic agroecosystem models that I'm talking about and that are used in many of the impact assessments, do not look at plant development. They do not represent how temperature or other things are going to affect flowering or fruiting or whether or not you're getting frost hardening or temperature hardening, any of those sorts of things. They mostly are looking at productivity and growth and at some extent to above ground plant phenology. We won't talk about how poorly they do below ground roots. And while I'm on what I will talk about, some of the other things that we might wish they would do that are important from the perspective of how climate change might impact agriculture, is they do not look at plant pathogens, how climate change is going to affect pathogens, or the sensitivity of those plants to pathogens under different climatic stresses. They don't do the pests themselves or the pollinators, of course. Now, what they do very well. So this is not really an argument against the models for what they're intended for, but there's many things we might like them to do that are important for looking at impacts on agriculture that they don't do. Now, there are models out there, of course, that do look at these things, but they generally don't show up in the generic ecosystem models that are used in the agricultural assessment and used in earth system models and climate models. And while I'm on, again, not sound like I'm beating up on them, but another thing that they are just now beginning to look at that I think is very important is acclimation. When plants are stressed, they don't just sort of curl up and die, so to speak. They, to the extent possible, they acclimate to those stresses and adapt in some way, and the models are just beginning in photosynthesis primarily, beginning to look at how that changes the response to temperature warming and such. And as you would expect, if the plants adapt to those warmer temperatures, the impact is less in when you're doing those impact assessments. And they don't do anything with the type of acclimation that's going to be, or is already dominant in agriculture and horticultural crops, the technology intervention that we do with agricultural crops, they don't treat any of that. So, knowing well what I was getting into in the sense of I was mostly going to be able to look at productivity and yield, when we started looking in the Gulf Coastal region, of the U.S. and as part of this DOE project I was talking about and looking at how agricultural in the region might be affected, I was interested in looking at a crop that was economically important and perhaps hadn't been worn out, so to speak, with many different people looking at it already, like corn and such. So my first thought was the Southeast, Florida. I look at citrus Florida, even though if you look at that map, there's a very small little sprinkling of places. Economically, it's more important. But it raises another issue is that you're probably aware of as well that these types of models generally don't do horticultural crops. This is the list from the AgMIP, which is a large international project that's comparing different ecosystem, agroecosystem models of different sophistication under common climate change and looking at how climate might affect agriculture. And not there's, as far as I can tell, not a horticultural crop in there unless you count potatoes. I saw some potato posters out there, so I guess potato is a horticultural crop. So maybe that would be one. Now, it's not surprising that the focus is, because of international food security issues, is on the staple commodity crops and how climate change might affect those. It's not surprising, and it's even appropriate, but it is a limitation when you're interested in looking at local impacts on horticultural crop using models, because they're not in there. So in the models that we had available, EPIC and DSAT, there was not citrus. And so instead of doing oranges in Florida, we did cotton in Texas. Economically important in Texas. There's not cool vintage postcards showing the harvesting of cotton. There, the pictures of harvesting of cotton from many years ago aren't very nice to look at. So I'm going to show you a couple of three slides of some of the results of some of those simulations that we're doing. And what we're looking at here is the yield of cotton lint from Bell County, Texas, and simulations with those two models, EPIC and DSAT, for a site at Temple, Texas, in Bell County. And the first thing that strikes you there is, and it's against annual precipitation, first thing strikes you there is, according to the statistics from the USDA, there's no effect of annual precipitation on, and this is non-irrigated cotton. We didn't make that simple mistake. This is rain-fed cotton in Bell County, and it's showing no relationship over the past 35 years with annual precipitation, whereas both of the models did. The difference between those two lines is not statistically significant, for whatever that's worth. They were both showing that higher annual precipitation would cause higher yields. Lots of reasons that might be. I actually, being a modeler, I can be more suspicious of the model than I can be of the data. It's not fair to be suspicious of folks that you aren't are. That it's potentially a oversensitivity of the crop models to soil moisture. It's sort of built in that, because we know that soil, you got to water plants, right? That soil moisture affects plant growth and productivity. But that could be put into models in too sensitive a way. I will also point out that there's no relationship in either of those models that says yield is some function of annual precipitation. This is a sort of phenomenological response of the model. It's responding to daily changes in precipitation, heat, evapotranspiration, and available soil water. And actually, the main point for showing this is I think that a more fundamental measure of how well the models represent reality is whether or not they're showing the right functional response with something that we can actually measure, rather than the actual individual numbers, because if I'm interested enough, I can spend time, I can calibrate my model to give you the right numbers. But I can't calibrate it to give you the right relationship. That needs to be a fundamental part of it. Whether or not the models are right here is a different matter. The other aspect of this is that one of the things that we're interested in is how, whether you use models or whether you use empirical results and different types of models that I'll show you in a moment, is how that influenced your heuristic or your expectations about what the future might be in a very general way from the point of view of people interested in vulnerability and impacts and those sorts of things, which is the group that I also work with. And so here's an obvious case that if you depended on the observations, your expectations of the future is that with changes in precipitation within that relatively large range, you wouldn't expect to see a change in yield. If you based your expectations on the model, you would. This goes into that same sort of analysis in a little more detail. This is from the AR4, the fourth IPCC assessment, and the model in a comparison, climate model in a comparison, CMIP, was called CMIP 3. It was a third of those. And this is looking at the GFDL 2.1, which is one of the climate models that has about 200 kilometer spatial resolution. The top panel there is the global version, 200 kilometer. And the bottom two panels, the middle one, is with a downscaling down to about 50 kilometers using what's called dynamic downscaling, where you nest a weather model inside of a global climate model to downscale those projections. And the bottom is a statistical downscaling where you use the statistics of the existing climate to downscale the course model results, in this case down to 12 kilometers. And then the historical period versus future. But the main point here is that, yes, it did matter in terms of this functional response of the model, the models, if you downscaled or didn't. So in other words, you get a different expectation of what the future might be if you use the global version impacts or you use the downscale. But it didn't matter a great deal which form of downscaling you used, which is probably only of interest to those of you who are familiar with the debate about downscaling, which gets rather acrimonious at times. It's almost like the debates that you get into with economists in the room on their different principles. And in our case, he found that it really doesn't make a great deal of difference. Even though the weather range, if you look at the middle panel, you get a different range of annual precipitation for this site than you do with the Cascade, the 12-kilometer resolution. But in terms of the functional response of the model, it's not that different. And we just repeated that for the AR5, the last assessment, the CMIP5, it was called. It was actually, well, I'm going to that. It's the fourth of those, but there was a CMIP4 that was used for something else. And it's basically showing three different versions of the same global model. There's no downscaling here. And the main thing to point out here is that in the global model, somehow between AR4 and AR5, they, I'd almost say, fixed it. They changed it so that you get results that look much more like the downscaled results than you did in that original model. So which version of the model you use, which period of the assessment that you're using to draw your expectations is one of those things that makes a difference. And so I'm going to close with a proposal of sorts for impact assessment that I'll confess is partly a result of my having done impact assessments following on from the climate change science. Refer you back to the AGMIP that we talked about. This is just a diagram from the AGMIP studies that shows climate feeding into crop models, feeding into agricultural economic models. And that's a logical way of thinking about it, because that's sort of the way it goes. And this is just a more complicated version of the same thing, where you have global warming or climate change all pointing in, influencing agricultural productivity. As best I can tell, there's one arrow pointing out the other direction from agricultural productivity to the human health and poverty and debt. But it's just another way of saying, showing that generally the way people think about this is you have a climate change projection and you feed that into an impact assessment model and you see what the results are. Might think about that if the climate change science is the dog, and the impact assessment is at the tail end of that process, and it's sort of the dog wagging the tail. Logical way of thinking about the problem, given that it's climate inputs to the impact, and you look at the different results for the assessments. But I'm proposing a little bit different way, where we sort of flip that around and think about it as the tail wagging the dog, where the impact assessment takes sort of the lead role and feeds information from that to the climate change science. And let me expand on that just a bit. This is a traditional way of looking at it. You have climate change. It feeds over into the horticultural science very often through a model. And from that, you get the impacts. And so, again, from my own perspective, we're sort of at the tail end of that process, and we sort of have to take whatever we get from the climate change science community. That's not always what we need to do the impact assessment. So an alternative approach, not a replacement, but an alternative complementary approach, is to start with the horticultural science, for in this case, and take what we understand about the sensitivities of those horticultural crops or the sensitivities in the models and the risks associated with certain types of climate change and the losses in productivity of crop or whatever else that we're interested in terms of the horticulture from the horticultural perspective, and identify essentially where does the system go belly up, under what conditions, weather conditions, climate conditions, are things going to be bad enough that we should be concerned about? Because in many cases, the impacts of the climate change, particularly in the next few years, aren't all that egregious. And so we may not be terribly concerned about them, but there are certain thresholds that we don't want to exceed that we know about, and we ought to explore where those are at, rather than just seeing what gets when we get a particular result. We may miss those thresholds, but yet there's uncertainty where that threshold might be exceeded, these wild cards, and we need to know about that. So start from the horticultural science or the impact area that one's looking at, find out what the sensitivities and risks are, and feed that back to the climate change community and ask them, essentially, how likely is that scenario to occur? They may not be able to tell you, or they may be able to tell you, but it at least changes the conversation in a way that I think is beneficial to both. We may be asking them questions about climate, and in particular, higher frequency aspects of climate, the weather, that they haven't thought about. And for example, we know with crop plants, hailstorms at the right time of the year can be extremely damaging. The models don't do hail. So I can't look at the probability of hail damage in these agricultural models, but if I ask them, what about hail, they might be able to look at that and come back with answers. So that's the proposal of sorts. I'm not sending it to NSF or anything, so you're welcome to use it. But a different way of thinking about the problem that I think is useful, particularly from the impact side of things, and especially when you're looking at very local effects to weather rather than climate and to extreme events. This might be an equally productive way of looking at things. So at the risk of mixing my metaphors and hopefully not upsetting the climate science people too much, I'll stop there and entertain your questions. The question was, we looked at the annual precipitation as the index of the climate change, and that's obviously a rather coarse representation of precipitation, and the timing of that precipitation is obviously something that the plants care about, either in general for growth and for particular parts of plant development. You're absolutely right. And we were suspicious of that when we first saw the result. But we actually looked into some of that. We looked at growing season precipitation, and it didn't change the overall result. We still had that difference in general behavior. It's also the annual precipitation for that particular region and over that particular time is very highly correlated with even the Palmer Drought Severity Index. We looked at that, and same results for that. So we're still a bit befuddled about why we see that difference. Again, as a modeler, I can think of things that I'm suspicious of the model being hypersensitive to, which is always possible. You build in certain things, it tells you that back. This is a way to try to avoid that circularity. There's also potentially issues with the yield statistics from the county, but I don't want to suggest that maybe they're wrong when I don't know that much about how they're done. Yes? The question is how much revision, refinement, updating of the temperature responses has occurred in these models when we know that some of the models we're using have used very simple linear temperature responses and we know that that's not the way temperature actually affects these. Most of the models that are used in the sort of AgMep type things still tend to use those older forms of temperature response. The ecosystem models that I work with more on a daily basis tend to have the more newly understood, the high temperature response causing degradation of proteins and such like that. But at least there are probably, changes going on all the time in models. They're very malleable, changing, but the current versions of the models that we're using, DSAT and EPIC, are still using some of the older responses.
Okay. Thank you, Dr.